Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Whether you're nearing retirement, entering the workforce for the first time, or caught somewhere in the confusing muddle in the middle, you're likely sensing it and you're probably living it. We know we are, and we want to know why. Listen in as we interview experts and everyday people like you to find out how best to navigate the ever-growing weirdness of work in the modern age.
Welcome to the Work is Weird Now podcast. Today's guest is Charlie Beswick, and we're going to be talking about who is taking care of the caregivers at work. But first, Charlie, can you introduce yourself?
I can, yeah. Lovely to be with you. I'm Charlie Beswick. I'm the director of Our Altered Life. And as you say, I work with organisations to help them value, recognise and better support the carers that work with them.
Amazing. We can't wait to get into that topic. And first, could you tell us what your weird work moment of the week is?
So I was thinking about this, and I think now that I'm self-employed, my weirdness of this week was literally just the morning rush. So getting up, rushing about to get the train, sorting out my son who is disabled, sorting out the dog, all those things I once did naturally now felt really strange. So yeah, probably not a typical answer, but I think, yeah, what is one person's normal is another person's weird. Yeah. So this morning for me, the rush was certainly a strange one.
Yeah, what a commute. And where have you commuted down to London from?
From Crewe train station. So a couple of hours in. So it was lovely, lovely journey.
Good. So care identification in the UK has jumped from 1 to 9 to 1 in 7 employees. And that's just those who have self-identified in that way. So what do you feel is behind that increase?
Yeah, I think there's loads of factors. I think slightly better awareness in the workplace. So we're getting there. It's slow and steady progress, but we're on, you know, it's on the way. Carers UK and organisations such as them, Contact, places like that, are working really hard to raise a profile of carers. And the numbers are increasing. Mm-hmm. So naturally, you know, if we've got a small percentage of people recognising, but that number overall is growing, then so is the impact.
Yeah, absolutely. And why do you feel that this is a problem for employees and employers both alike?
Okay, so you've got two different sectors there. For employees with caring responsibilities, they are almost showing up to, well, they've done a full day's work before they get to work in the first instance. You know, you're doing a job for love before you do a job for pay. And so you can turn up to work having had very little sleep, got the weight of the world on your shoulders because you're thinking about literally the life of another person in your hands, you know, whether that's their medication, appointments, all of those kind of aspects are all on your shoulders. So it's a big weight. And if employees are turning up at work and they're not disclosing that, they've almost got to mask that identity and they can't show up fully as themselves. So you've got that disconnect, which can, you know, short term, okay, but long term can really lead to burnout, anxiety, depression, all of those mental health issues that nobody wants to face.
But unfortunately, anyway. Yeah.
You know, and unfortunately come alongside care responsibilities at the best of times, let alone when you're hiding that part of your life as well.
Yeah.
So I think for employees, that's the challenge. And for employers, tons. You know, if carers are not recognised and not valued and not given the compassion that they deserve when they're doing a job that they probably didn't want to do. You know, I'm my son's carer. I would much rather him have been born a healthy, you know, sort of adaptable, thriving young man. That would have been my choice for him. Mm. Nobody chooses to be a carer. And I think employers sometimes forget that when they're coming to ask for time off or carers leave. So I think where reasonable requests aren't met, where carers aren't supported, employers are losing really good talent, really rich talent. You know, the transferable skills that come from caring are amazing. And there's a 50% chance that women aged 46 will become carers and a 50% chance for men aged 57. And at that age, you know, they're your core employees who are knowing the business inside and out, who you've invested your work, your training in, who are cheering everybody along and keeping the team together. And, you know, so this caring is impacting every layer of the business. And without the support, then aspects like retention are being hit, you know, sort of morale, reputation of the business, productivity, engagement, absenteeism levels. It just hits every aspect of the business where carers aren't supported.
I've just been really taken back by the difference in the two ages there. That I think we're on camera and I think my jaw did literally just dropped. And that is a big, is it 10, 11 year difference?
11 years difference, yeah.
Between the gender. And that's, Yeah.
So I think I'd like to just take a step back before we continue and talk about the definition of the word carer, because I think conventionally, or at least in my view, I think of a carer as being someone who looks after someone who's ill or disabled in their family. Uh-huh. However, being a 47-year-old woman now and having aging parents and, you know, early teenage kids at home, that is caring on some level as well. I've got caring responsibilities, not in a sort of out of the norm kind of situation, but it does put pressure on my life. So how do you define caring in this context?
So I think Carers UK, I'm going to absolutely butcher their definition here, but it's something along the lines of where you are caring for somebody who is elderly, they've got some sort of disability, illness, also addiction, mental health issues. So those are a couple of areas that people often neglect. And those people cannot live their life without your support. Then that's classed as a carer. And certainly for me as a parent, so I've got twin boys, one is neurotypical and fine, the other one is autistic and disabled. And I saw when they were probably about six that I could ease back a little bit from Oliver. He was, you know, he was toileting, he was dressing himself, and Harry wasn't. And I was like, okay, so this is the difference. I'm still doing those things for my six-year-old, for Harry, that I'm not doing for Oliver. And so, yeah, I think being a carer is slight, it's nuanced, but it is different to caring for our loved ones. But yes, certainly, you know, having the responsibility of another person who has illness, disability, mental illness, addiction, those kind of issues.
Okay. So you often say in your work that employers need carers more than they realize. So can you tell us more about why you think carers make good employees and how can workplaces better recognize that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's some really crucial skills and qualities that carers bring from their caring responsibilities into the workplace. So resilience is always the number one. When I'm talking to carers, they always say, I'm more resilient for being a carer than I ever would have been beforehand. And then you've got things like reading the room. So my son's nonverbal to a large degree now. He's got some language, but he couldn't have a conversation. But I can read his body language. I can read the way he snuffles. I can read, you know, and being in a room with professionals and they're all kind of looking at each other over Harry's head. And you get very, very good at reading people. And I think that's a skill that's hard to learn, but it's something that we've developed very naturally. And I think that's really important. I think we are massively tenacious. You know, we don't take no for an answer and we just keep going. And we've got good perspective. So, you know, my son Harry has had his skull taken apart twice. I've had to sign loads of disclaimers to say that he might die in surgery. And that really puts problems into perspective. So if a carer is worrying, then it's, you're probably right to be worrying. But if they're not panicking, then it's okay. So I think we bring that perspective in and that sense of priority. And we like to keep a place calm. We don't lose our heads easily. We've got great empathy skills. So there's a whole host of, you know, what typically would be called soft skills. But also you've got those organisational skills, time management. And you carers absolutely love their jobs. It's lots of people go to work for financial reasons and maybe for purpose as well. But when you're a carer for somebody else, the workplace gives you so much more. You know, it gives you that identity. It gives you an opportunity to socialise with other adults and the rest of the human world. Like, wow, you know, a space for personal, professional development. All of those aspects that are lost when we are caring for the needs of somebody else all the time. So, yeah, we bring a lot to the workplace and we're very grateful for our workplaces. And I think the second part of your question was, what can workplaces do to recognise carers?
Yeah.
Is that right? I think it's a challenge because the statistic is that it typically takes about 2 years for a carer to recognise that that's their role.
That they're actually a carer.
That they're actually a carer. I would argue it takes a lot longer. Took me 6-7 years. And to see themselves as a carer, not just a daughter or a mum or, you know, somebody doing their duty. So I think the awareness piece is crucial for organisations to get that out there so that people can see that they are carers and recognise that themselves. And then you know, have that culture where it's okay to step forward and say, I've got caring responsibilities, and there won't be a stigma. There won't be people rolling their eyes and thinking, great, you're going to be a bit of an inconvenience to us now, you know. So I think that's always the first place, is that awareness piece.
Mm. What do you think are some of those misconceptions about carers in the workplace? What do bosses think when they hear that someone's got caring responsibilities?
Yeah, I think they think they're going to be not as dedicated, need lots of time off, be an inconvenience, maybe a burden.
Yeah.
That they aren't going to be a safe bet for promotions and things like that. And sometimes I think it comes from, I was going to say a good place. It's not a good place, but I think sometimes managers think, I won't put more burden on these people because right. they've already got such a lot to carry. Mm. So I think sometimes you've got the manager that kind of frowns on the caring responsibility and doesn't see the value. And then you've got the carer that the manager that really does see that this person's got a lot on their shoulders and doesn't want to add to that. So you've got those two aspects. I will say the former is probably more prevalent. Yeah, certainly.
Have you, what are your personal experiences with, you know, good management in this instance?
Yeah, I've been super fortunate in my roles, in my jobs. I was a teacher for 20 years. So education isn't the sort of place that you can ask for flexible working. Mm. That, you know, that's really challenging. But I've been really lucky. When I first qualified as a teacher, I asked two head teachers if they would take me on, mm-hmm. you know, sort of employ me. And one said, sure, you know, you've got a disabled son, but we'll work around that. And then the other one stopped me in my tracks and said, like, we know you. We know how good you are. We know you give above and beyond. You know, Harry comes first. And I was really loyal to that head for a long time. And then the second school that I went to, they allowed me some reasonable adjustments, which we might touch on a little bit later. But that meant that I could do my job and still care for Harry at the same time. I didn't have to choose between the job I valued and the son I adore. Mm. And so I was employed on a 6-week contract and stayed with them for 7 years. Well, you know, so
it's doable. And I think we'll come on to those adjustments, what the options are for people. One of the things that we really went into in our discovery call was around that difference between support and pity when it comes to carers and why that's important. And I think some of the things that we're trying to do with this podcast is talk about the language that should be used with people don't know, because there's some things that people just don't know and don't understand. Could you shed some light on that for us?
Yeah, I think, you know, it is a hard journey. It is a challenge to have somebody's life in your hands. It's a huge responsibility. But it's also a huge privilege, and it's also incredibly rewarding. And you build relationships and bonds with these people that are absolutely beautiful. And so I never, ever want pity from people when they're listening to maybe how hard we've got things. You know, I don't want people to pity us. But you're right. You know, people don't always know what to say when they're supporting somebody. And I would just say to say that, you know, to be honest and say, I've got no experience of caring. I can't imagine how hard that is.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'm here and, you know, what can I do?
Yeah.
And I think just, we talked before we started recording about the elephant in the room, you know, kind of mm-hmm. just, I'm a big fan of addressing that. And I think people can, because people are scared to say the wrong thing, sometimes they say nothing.
Yes.
And then it becomes awkward, you know. And some carers, I'm an oversharer, okay. Some carers aren't. Some don't want to be sharing war and peace about their lives because A, they come to work for a break, B, they value their privacy, C, they want to protect the dignity of the people they're caring for. So it is a very individual decision. And if somebody's coming forward and saying, I've got caring responsibilities, then that's a big step for them. And sometimes that's all that they want to say. And other times, like me, they'll tell you the ins and outs of life and bore you to tears with Harry's challenges and achievements. But I think just being there for people is a lot. You know, a cup of tea and a biscuit goes a long way when somebody's had a really tough day.
Yeah.
Hmm. I mean, I'm wondering, when we started speaking on for this episode, we were talking about what's changed that has created more carers in the workplace. And I'm curious, and maybe this is a whole Pandora's box of stuff, but I'm curious how the state support of carers has changed over your son's lifetime. Like, how have you seen access to sort of social resources change, if you have, in that time? And what is available for people that helps them to balance work with caring responsibilities right now.
Yeah, I think there's been great efforts. Mm. I don't always think it's very successful. There's nothing blanket across the country in the UK that supports everybody in the same way. So we have the education healthcare plans for children, EHCPs, and that's decided by local authorities, and it can be a bit of a lottery as to whether you're granted an EHCP for your child's needs, how long that takes. There's mm-hmm. massive years and years of waiting lists to support families. And then the other end, you know, you've got illness and you've got hospice and you've got care homes. They're oversubscribed. The care is hit and miss. Mm. So I think that there's good intentions there, but it's definitely not universal yet. And it's not accessible for everybody. And it's definitely not easy.
Right.
So it's always the families that have the support networks or the resources that know how to push and know how to fight that get on a little bit quicker and a little bit better. And I always feel sorry for, particularly around children that have got additional needs. Often those parents might have additional needs themselves, or certainly so, you know, anxieties and social anxiety, and they don't have the same level of support and confidence. Yes. So that's a real challenge for families. It's just to know where to go for support, accessing it, and knowing whether it's going to be successful or not. It is a bit of a lottery, and it's unfair. Really,
and then
unfair.
A barrier. It just becomes a huge barrier.
A huge barrier, yeah. I mean, Harry is eligible for a benefit, but the hoops we have to jump through to get that, I just thought, you know what, I've got other things to be doing at the moment, so I've not applied. You know, he's been eligible for nearly 2 years now, and that's money to him, rightfully, that is his. And I've just not applied. And it's just because I've been busy. But there will be lots of people that don't know how to and can't even begin with that process. So it's very difficult. I think it's purposely difficult to create barriers for those people.
That's tough. I mean, I think what you were talking about before in terms of what carers can bring to the workplace, there is obviously that empathy piece, but also this advocacy that has to happen outside of the workplace, right?
Absolutely.
The ability to fight the system and fight for what you want must be a valuable skill for employers as well.
Definitely. That ability to think creatively, think around a problem, you know, think outside of the box, build your evidence bank, really fight your corner, state your case. They're all very, very, you know, they're great skills. They're exhausting skills to be using day in, day out, but it's an inner resource that's really powerful.
Yeah, and real communication skills too.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, really good, not just the speaking side of it, but the listening. What does this mean for me? Because there's a lot, you know, communication's two-way, right? But everybody focuses on the spoken part of communication, and not many people really focus on listening well. And I think carers do that because we have a lot of information to take in, and we have to sort of assimilate that and
process
it all. And I think that's a really powerful skill in the workplace.
Do you think there's an impression among carers that the workplace is not a place for them? It's not something they can sustain. And if so, what advice would you give to those people to think about going back into the workforce? What skills should they take with them?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, I know many carers that have had to leave work. 600 carers a day leave the UK workforce because they just can't juggle the commitments of both the workplace and their caring. And I think carers can only do so much. You know, they bring their best selves to the workplace with all, you know, sort of all the passion that they can give. I think the onus is on workplaces more so than the actual carers. My argument would be, why should a carer have to come and fight when they're already fighting for somebody they love?
Right.
Why should they fight to be valued when they offer so much? And so those organisations who do that well, Centrica, BT, Equinix, Assurance, companies that I'm working with at the moment, you know, they're retaining great staff, 20 years, 25 years. I think it's on the companies to recognise it and step up.
So what does doing it well look like? Can you put that into like a real practical?
Yeah, sure. So it looks like paid leave. It looks like flexible hours where that can happen. It looks like not micromanaging and trusting people to get the job done. It looks like measuring output rather than hours. Mm-hmm. And they're not massive. They're not massive things. You know, it should be in this day and age. If COVID taught us anything, you know, we can work flexibly and we can get the work done. But unfortunately, there seems this reluctance to allow people to work flexibly and this distrust and mistrust around what people are going to do with their own time. I was at the hospital all day with my son and worked late into the evening last night to get the hours back. You know, we can do it and we do do it. And it's not just carers, lots of people do that as well. But yeah, the paid leave's a huge one as well. Centrica offer 6 weeks of paid carers leave. And interesting, what they found is that actually on average 3.4 days of that care leave is taken.
Wow.
And yeah, it's a, it, you know, you would think people would say, oh, okay, well, if you're given 6 weeks off, people might take four of them, you know? No, 3.4 days, because I think what employers don't realise is when we're coming to ask for carers leave, our carers are struggling. The ones we care for are struggling then. They're in distress at that point. They need support. We'd rather be at work. I'd much rather be at work than be at hospital because my son's had another epileptic seizure. I would choose that every day. You know, so I think where you've got that paid leave, it just gives that safety net of, I can come to you. I can use this if I need it.
Is there a stigma then around people not using it because the days are still so low? The days being used are still so
It's a great question. I think that's probably one for Centrica because they're definitely leading the way in that. I know BT offer 2 weeks paid leave. So, yeah, certainly that's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. I would imagine so. But I know that Centrica have, and I use them just because they are literally leading the way, their absence rate, unplanned absence rates have massively decreased. Because they are, employees are able to come and say, look, I need this flexibility, I need this wriggle room, I need, and so, you know, their bottom line is benefiting. 1.8 billion they've saved. So huge. We're talking big money.
And the things you're asking these companies to do are not things that they shouldn't be arguably doing for their entire workforce.
Absolutely.
Right? And we touched on at the beginning about the sandwich generation, which is a topic I find really interesting for the aforementioned reason, which is that I feel like I'm very much in it right now. And it feels like those types of policies would also accommodate people who are, through no fault of their own, but by virtue of there being a lot of baby boomers who are living a lot longer, are in this situation far more than usual.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what works for carers works for everybody. And I think, you know, right at the beginning, we talked about that increase in numbers, but also we've got a change in language. So we've got sandwich carers as a term now. So that was never used, you know, maybe 20 years ago. We've got kinship care. That is something that organisations aren't really aware of yet.
Can you define that for us, please?
Sure. So kinship care is where a relative steps in when maybe a child is about to be taken away from a family member. So, for example, if my sister's children were, for no, you know, through nobody else's fault, having to have respite or temporary foster care somewhere else, I would step in and say, I don't want them to go to a third party. I'll have them instead. So we get a lot of grandparents with kinship care rights. So if their own children are having a mental health breakdown or, you know, they require specialist treatment, where do the children go? Well, grandma and grandpa will step up and have them. So again, that's just something that would have been taken for granted years ago. But now we're hearing terms like carers, carers' responsibilities, care, you know, caring needs, kinship care, sandwich carers. And so people are sort of hearing these and thinking, well, yeah, that's me. That's what I do.
Are there certain conditions held by the people who are being cared for that are almost more likely to be accepted than others? We touched on mental health, for example. Is it harder to persuade an employer, for example, that looking after someone with mental health issues is as legitimate as looking after somebody with a more visible disability?
Yeah, I would imagine so. You know, I mean, there's a huge stigma around disability in general. You know, not all disabilities are visible. So it makes sense that there would be a stigma around that. Certainly mental health, absolutely addiction. Because I think there's an assumption that, well, if somebody's an addict, it's up to them to sort that problem out. Opposed to the family unit who it naturally has a knock-on effect and who are rallying around and trying to help that person through it. So certainly I think mental health issues, there's a stigma in general for those individuals, let alone their wider support network. So yeah, I think people are, and you know, I think there's an assumption that caring is just for your older relatives. Carers are just the people that look after mums and dads when they get to a certain age. And I think there's a huge awareness piece around what that actually looks like. And mental health is one part of that for sure.
You mentioned when it takes people a while to realise that they're carers. And I think post-COVID, I know a number of people who developed long COVID and were suddenly in situations where their spouse became a de facto carer for them.
Yep.
What would you recommend to people who suddenly find themselves in a situation where they are do have caring responsibilities? How do they start to identify as that? And then what would you suggest is a conversation they have with their workplace at that moment?
Yeah, so I think there's a few questions to ask yourself to recognize whether you are a carer or not. Things like, is my personal time impacted by my caring responsibilities? Is my freedom and my choices, are they impacted? Because where some people might one day be able to go and have lunch with a friend, the next day they're caring for their husband or their relative and actually they can't. And could that person function if you weren't there? So if you weren't in the house with them or if you weren't in the vicinity with them, would they be safe? Would they be healthy without you? And if the answer is no, then there's a very high chance that you are a carer. And the second part of the question was?
And then what conversation do you have with your employer at that time?
I think line manager, first of all, is just coming to them and saying, you know, I'm in a situation at the moment where I'm caring for X, Y, and Z. This can be really challenging for me at home. I just want you to know, and you're still going to get the very best of me, but I want you to know that I've got this going on in the background. And take it from there. You know, a great leader will be brilliant. What can we say? What can we do? The alternative to that might not always be brilliant. And then we've got the HR route as well, which I think HR, sometimes people fear going to HR. They think it's the worst case. But HR are there to support you, just like line managers are.
Mm. Yeah, just hearing you talk, I was just imagining myself being in the manager role and hearing that. And actually, I think even just that small reassurance, I'm still just as committed as I've ever been, is actually maybe a really important detail, because I think immediately your mind would go to, oh, no, I've got to fill in this gap in resource. And actually hearing that might just give me the reassurance I need to be able to move forward with confidence.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think sometimes what people have chosen to do deliberately is to wait maybe 6 months and then go to their manager and say, I have been caring for the past 6 months. And so that they can see there's been no change in their work ethic. There's been no change. There's been no drop in their performance and their commitment. So that if that is ever questioned, you could say, well, it's been on for a while and you've not noticed until I've come to tell you. So there's that aspect as well, because it's, you know, it is big to disclose these things.
Mm. And to flip it then, what practical ways can managers build trust with an employee or a team member who's come to the minute and shared that personal level of detail? What can they then do if there's managers listening?
Yeah, thank them. Thank them for sharing that. You know, it's a big part of their lives. So I think just to say thank you for sharing that, for coming forwards. What do you need? What do you need from me? Because it will look differently for different people. And I think managers automatically assume that people will say, well, I want paid leave and I want flexible hours. And that's actually not the case for everybody. You know, some carers work absolutely fine full time, but they might need to come in 10 minutes later or leave 10 minutes earlier. Or, you know, there's just those small tweaks that can make a massive difference. So I would say to managers not to be afraid to say, what do you need? I can't promise you that I can meet everything that you need, but is there a middle ground? What can we do to make life easier for you right now?
Mm.
And I think just meeting them where they are is really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And following up.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they're promising something, then make sure it happens because there's got to be that level of trust there.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you mentioned you're working with a number of different organizations to better integrate kind of response to carers within the workforce.
Yeah.
When you go into these organizations, what is usually the first thing, like the first quick win? You say, you've got to deal with this first.
Ooh, great question. It's the awareness piece.
Mm.
It's the awareness piece. The two things that organizations say to me is, We know we've got carers, but people aren't recognising it in themselves, and we want to help managers better support them. And they're always the two things. It's just having those tricky conversations.
Yeah, and it's got to be the starting point, right?
Yeah.
If no one's aware, then how do you move forward together?
Yeah, exactly. Some companies will come and say, right, we've done a baseline and now we want to find this out. And I'm like, you've done a baseline. Have you asked how many carers you've got? And they'll be like, yeah. I'm like, okay, go back again and ask how many people have got caring responsibilities. And see the difference in the numbers.
Right, that's vast.
It's huge.
Yeah.
People do not want to see themselves, label themselves as a carer, but they will admit that they have caring responsibilities. And it's a tiny little shift in the syntax, but it makes a massive difference. And that opens up a whole host of different, richer data that you can then work with and support people.
So this has obviously become a real passion project for you.
Yeah.
What is your ambition for what's next in terms of your ability to influence this discussion? Where do you picture your career going from here?
I think the teacher in me doesn't want to be a tick box exercise. I'm in everything I do for sustainable change, for sustainable impact. And for me, that would look like working with organisations beyond the awareness piece and really helping them to shape the longevity, the sustainability of supporting those carers so that we can see a tangible outcome after 12 months, 18 months and so on. So for me, I can't change the world, unfortunately. I would love to. And I can't change the carers' reality. You know, that's the other thing. Carers, we know that people can't fix the world for us. Mm. But you can make life a little bit easier where that's possible. And if I can play a part in that, then I'd be absolutely thrilled.
I'm assuming that this disproportionately impacts women. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. There are more male carers than you would assume. So Flamingo Chicks are a wonderful charity. They did a study and spoke to 500 dads who were all carers, and only 10% had disclosed to their employer that they were a carer.
Mm.
So there will be men in the workforce, for whatever reason, whether that's pride, whether it's privacy, that are not disclosing. And there are more men caring as the numbers of people requiring care is increasing. But yeah, disproportionately women for sure.
Yeah, I mean, that challenges some of the discussions that we have around identity and work as well, and how much men, perhaps more than women, or at least to some extent, identify very strongly with what they do at work, and so therefore are less willing to accept another aspect of their identity, maybe. I don't know if you deal in any way with how people sort of see themselves in this context and whether that's often a barrier.
Well, it's interesting because, excuse me, the companies that I've worked with have been, the individuals have been predominantly male.
Really?
Interesting.
Yes, really interesting. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the organisations that I'm working with have employee resource groups, ERGs, and there's lots of men heading those. So, yeah, it's definitely not as cut and dry as people assume it is. And I think that's another stereotype that people need to be a little bit cautious of, is just assuming that this only impacts women. Mm-hmm. You know, it absolutely does. But it is also impacting men, and increasingly so.
Mm-hmm. Right. That's great to know. So how can people reach you and find out more about the work that you're doing?
So I'm on LinkedIn, and people can email me at charlie@ouralterlife.com. I'm having conversations with organisations. I've got resources for organisations and for employees as well. I've got the Do I Care ebook that they can buy, which is a little checklist with some self-care tips and some scripts on how to work with managers, whether that's face-to-face or over email, because I definitely want to create the workplace I would have valued as a new carer, for sure.
What would your one piece of advice be to somebody who is a caregiver or doesn't, you know, totally identify themselves as a carer? What would your one piece of advice be to them?
This sounds really cheesy, but it would be take care of you first. It really would. I heard a quote a few years ago, and it said, "You say that you would die for your children, but will you live for them?" And that really, really hit me. So it would be, you know, take care of you. Mm. And it's not selfish to put yourself first sometimes, because when somebody's life's in your hands, you have to take care of yourself and make sure you're there for them. Mm. So I think that would be it, really.
One more question. Sorry.
She lies.
Do you think work can almost be therapy?
Absolutely. Absolutely it can. It was for me. So work for me was respite. Work for me was distraction. I have zero doubt that my mental health was massively helped and supported by the workplace, by being seen just for who I was and not just Harry's mum, for being allowed to thrive and have challenges that were outside of the caring sphere, you know, and listening to other people's problems and just being able to distract yourself a little bit. 100%, yeah, the workplace is amazing for carers, and carers are amazing for the workplace.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.